This is a Gathering Heritage project interview recorded in County Louth in Ireland.
Now, I'm delighted to welcome to our Gathering Heritage project Sergeant Ricardo Lucchesi. Why did you join the army and what possessed you to? Because there was very few people joining the army around that time, wasn't there?
Well, contrary to that, actually, Harry, there was quite a lot of us joined. I joined straight out of school in 1985. I was just turned 18. I suppose by the time I turned 16, I was looking at a career in the army. I was at the Morrist, and I was going to really consider some sort of career in journalism or writing because I had a gift at the time for writing. But the army appealed to me. It was a friend of mine, Raymond Clark, whose father, Frau, had been a sergeant here. I was always asking about the army, and he wasn't long after returning from South Lebanon. It was something that appealed to me. And of course, I joined the FCA in November 1984.
Was that a good training to get used to?
Oh, for sure, yeah, for sure. Anybody that was kind of keen or into military, the FCA was very good training ground initially for us. So there was an awful lot of my peers, my friends, joined the FCA. And an awful lot of us from that particular recruit platoon in the FCA made the leap to come into the regular army.
Rico, can you answer? Is the FCA still going?
The FCA is still going, but it's now called the Army Reserve. And as opposed to being a separate battalion, they're now part of the 27th Battalion or whatever battalion they belong to within the army. But and going back to that, a number of my friends came into the regular army. Myself, Raymond Clark, as I mentioned earlier, and Pat Sloan. If you remember Pat, his father, Matt Sloan, at the Century Bar. So the three of us were tight, and the three of us joined together back in November 1985. And I'm still here.
And where did you go to immediately? Can you remember leaving your house the first morning to join?
Of course. Now, we initially joined our recruit training here in Aiken Barracks, or Dundalk Military Barracks at the time. And I remember thinking, now this is it. This is not playing a game anymore. This is the real thing. So we came in on a Thursday, I think, and to acclimatise, to get uniforms and kit. We were sent home the weekend and told to return back on Sunday night. And we all came in all eager, all fresh-faced. I think the youngest was Pat Sloan. He was 17. And the eldest of the whole platoon was another guy who'd already been in the army and come back out. So we were very young men, I suppose, or youngsters. And kids, if you look back on it, when you think about it. But we all came together back in November 1985 into Dundalk here. We trained here.
Is it normal for you to be sent to the hometown or normally away?
It depends. The army is changing, of course, but at the time there was a big recruiting drive here and we were recruited for the 27th Battalion to serve within the 27th Battalion, either Dundalk or Gormanstown or Castleblaney at the time. But we'd done a 6-month recruit training here. And I remember thinking that when I left school, as we all did, I remember I just done my leaving cert the previous June. So this is a couple of months later. And I'd been working with my dad in a restaurant in Newry at the time, in a chip shop, and thinking, what am I going to do in my future? Am I going to go to Italy? I'll see if I get into the army, what happens. So when I left school, I said, that's it. Nobody's going to ever tell me what to do again. I'm my own man. Nobody's going to ever watch me making my own way in life. A couple of weeks later, I'm running up and down a Red Barns Road with a rifle over my head and a corporal screaming at me. Well, that's the choice I took.
Just mention your dad there. Did you ever think of that you would spend your life making chips?
Yes, believe it or not, yeah, we thought maybe, because my dad had been, obviously, as you know, he'd been in the business since the late 50s, and we thought it was a natural progression, but it's kind of, my sisters and my brother and I didn't really kind of want to go there, but I felt, look, it's something we can go into, but it's not really what I wanted to do. I wanted to, as I said to you, I wanted to become maybe, do something writing, or and the army just appealed to me. I think something about the army when I was about 16, and certainly got into the FCA, It struck at me, yeah.
You mentioned there about running up and down the Key Street there. Did you find, how long or many months or was it years before you actually settled down and to make a career out of it?
Well, the recruit training is a 6-month period. It's very, very intensive and it's very difficult, but it's something you do together. The whole idea of recruit training is that you come in as an individual and they get you all to work together. And that's kind of really why I still like being in the army. I love the unity. I like that we work together. I like that we belong together. It doesn't take you too long to settle down. As a recruit, remember, as a baby soldier, everything's new to you. Everything's difficult. You don't get home at night time. You don't get home a lot of weekends. They tell you when to go to bed, when to eat, when to shower, when to shave. But you settle down quickly because you're all doing it, and that's where you start bonding together. And once you bond together, you settle down. But my time in the army, yeah, I suppose when recruit training finished, I was posted to Castleblaney, And remember, it was the height of the trouble, so it's the late 80s, and we were patrolling quite a lot and a lot of regimental duties. But you settle in, you think, yeah, this is something I'd like to do. My initial contract was for 3 years. And I remember thinking the first year, well, I'll definitely do the 3 years and I'll see what happens. Maybe I'll go and spend some time in Italy. But I think by the second year, we were going to Lebanon, and I really think, well, this is sort of the career I want to make. So I re-engaged from 3 to 6 years, and then I continued on, and I'm still here.
Enrico, being in your own town and in the army, which is a completely different world than you were used to, in the town, going up the town with the boys and everything like that, were you able to mix at all with anybody from the town?
Oh, for sure. Like, everybody was in the platoon. There was 36 of us in our recruit platoon. 30 of us were from Dundalk. 25 at least were from Dundalk. There was never an issue like that. And look, I'm suppose you remember, Harry, as well, when the army first came here in the late 60s and early 70s, before they start recruiting locally, you know, there was an awful lot of friction. There was an awful lot of problems. But, you know, young fellas coming from Dublin and mixing with the problems that we had in Dundalk, the political problems and the geographical problems. But that, by the time I joined, that was gone. Look, my dad had a chip shop, you remember, in Wooden Place. It catered for soldiers, so my dad knew a lot of the soldiers by the time I was coming to enlist.
When you mentioned Lebanon there, how many years do you have to be in the army before they would send you overseas?
Well, at the time it was about a year, but it's probably about a year, maybe 2 years now before you can.
That's very, very young, isn't it, to be sent away?
Not necessarily, no, Harry, because you've been trained extensively and you're good to go.
And your special training?
Well, before you deploy overseas, you do a lot of training. It's called pre-deployment training. And mission-ready exercises you do to prepare you for doing the specific mission you're going on. But at the time we went to Lebanon in the 80s, remember, we'd about 700 soldiers there. And you could literally go 6 months, come home 6 months and go again. It's not like that now because there isn't as many soldiers going overseas.
And how were you picked?
You volunteer. Like, remember, we're all volunteers, every one of us. Every one of us has put our hands up. Nobody's invited. Nobody went outside. Nobody, as we were passing Barrack Street Gate, nobody threw a rope over us and dragged us in. We all volunteered.
But and before you went, Rico, had you these ideas of what it was going to be? Was it going to be very dangerous? And did all things go through your mind?
Of course, Harry, but it's an adventure. Remember, you're all 19, 20. It's an adventure. And it's something you aspire as a professional soldier. You aspire to serve overseas. Like, you get away from the routine of the barrack life. And overseas was the goal. And we'd see all the guys coming back from the Leb, as it was called, you know what I mean? With the suntans and nice watches. And I want some of that. You know what I mean? So it was the fact that you were travelling to another country, something that was on the news constantly, and it was an adventure, and we all couldn't wait to go. And we all.
How did your mum Maureen and your dad think about you going over there?
You know, retrospectively, you're 20 years old. It's nothing to do with them. It's me, but you have to think about them, and of course you think about them. But when I went the first time, we went in November 1987. Remember, there was no mobile phones, there was no... It's like you see in the old films, the biggest thing was the guys coming around the post call once a week, you know, when you'd all be gathered and they'd call out your name for a letter. And there'd be one fellow...
And did that happen?
That happened, yeah, because it's not a lifetime ago, but there was no mobile phones, there was no, you know...
And were you looking forward to the letters and letters, hearing all about Dundalk?
Yeah, and you get the Argus sent over to you, you know, the Argus and the Democrat, which, fantastic. And Mam would wrap a couple of tea bags in them and send them out to you as well, you know, stuff like that. It's something that we think, because we take for granted now when you go overseas, everything can go with you, and you can Skype home, and you can FaceTime home now. And you know,
well, are you told very much about conditions over there? Is there films or videos that they show you?
Again, you come back 1987 when I first deployed to Lebanon. Yes, there was an awful lot of information, but not necessarily the way you have it now. Like, you, again, without sounding too old, you know, you don't know YouTube, there was no social media. But you were going on the guys telling you and the training you got. So the training was kind of reflective of what you'd be doing over there. And then, so when you land in Lebanon, of course, it's a huge, well, not so much surprise, but it's a huge expedition for you. And but you kind of hit the ground running, you know what to expect. And when you get to the ground, you're given a rifle, you get to Lebanon, you're given a rifle, and you're told, right, you're reporting for duty tomorrow. You go to bed, and then you're on duty then for 6 months. But it was great.
And you enjoyed it.
Oh, Harry, can I tell you? Look, I've had 35 years I'm in the job, you know what I mean? Does that not answer your question, you know what I mean?
Overseas
is something... When I look now, and I see 20 and 21-year-olds and 22-year-olds up the town, you know what I mean? You see the kids now, and without being too disparaging towards them, We were kids. We were 20. Pat Sloan was the youngest man in Lebanon, the youngest Irish soldier in Lebanon. He hit his 19th birthday in Lebanon. Youngest man, you know what I mean? And we were all kids going over. And it was a great growing up. It was, you know, you matured so quickly. Well, maybe it took us another couple of years to mature, but you grew up very quickly. And you're responsible for the guy next to you. You just weren't responsible for yourself. You looked after the guy next to you. And that's what being a soldier
was. Was it dangerous at the beginning when you went out at the very beginning?
Oh, look, it's dangerous. Yeah, it's dangerous. Remember, you're going into a war zone, volatile. And the United Nations were caught in the middle of it. We're the buffer zone between what was happening. But the Irish are very good at this. And it's something I do when I give the talks here in the museum. We're not a fighting army. We're not a huge standing army. We're not, you know, we're not the Americans or the British, but we're Irish, and we're very proud to be Irish. Remember, I'm half Italian. We're very good at saying, what's the crack? We're very good at settling things down. And also, that when we go to particularly Lebanon and to other countries we've gone to, we're not seen as colonialists. There's no baggage with the Irish. We're not there. We're not there for any other reason than to make sure you're okay. And that's something we're all very proud of.
Yeah, and Rico, that was the first time you went out, and you came back then.
I went out in November 1987, rotated back home in April 1988, following a 6-month tour of duty.
And then, how long was it before you went out again?
I went out again then, winter time again in October. Or November.
Volunteering again?
Volunteering. I mean, as soon as you come home, you volunteer. Do you know you volunteer? But you come back, you do your regimental duties, you do a couple of courses. I was back in Castleblaney. Back doing your guard duties, your patrolling of the border, and you're all keen to go back overseas again because, you know, you want to go back and do it a second time. And I volunteered, and I got selected to go again in, late October, November 1989. So we got everything prepared, and we went, we started training in Dundalk here and then in Dublin, and then we deployed again, and it's gone back into the same area, meeting the same people, because you rotate around the same place, and you go meet the villagers and it's all...
So was it easier for you going the second time?
Second time, because you knew what to expect. And some people will tell you, it's worse because now you know what's coming. Do you know what I mean? You know, born in toilet roll. Oh. Yeah.
Rico, can I just slightly answer you? You mentioned a few times Border Patrol that time. Was that a dangerous job? We don't know. We know when we were driving cars up and you'd see the soldiers there. But was it? Were you in danger?
There was never a specific threat set on the Irish forces, be it the Guard or the Army along the border. But it had happened. You know, there's incidents along the border and indeed in the rest of Ireland where guards and soldiers have been killed in the line of duty. So there is. Look, when you're a soldier, you carry a rifle, and that itself is an inherent danger because obviously you're there to carry a rifle to protect somebody against somebody else who's got a rifle or a weapon. So that's inherently but we're well trained, and it's, you know, you're used to it. But the thing of it is, it's important that you don't fall into the mediocrity. You think, look, nothing's going to happen. So, you know, you kind of don't. As professionals, you don't. So you just up that a wee bit when you go to Lebanon. And you go to Lebanon, there's an awful lot of stuff going on. You know, Lebanon, I always remember, it was just, all of a sudden, it exploded and then it come down again. Like, the people were very good. You know, the people that we mixed with, lived cheek and jowl with, the locals, they were just like everybody else, just trying to get on with their lives.
Could you speak English over there?
A lot of them speaking. Look, they were selling you stuff. Of course they spelled it selling English, you know what I mean? They were selling from cans of Cokes, the watches. To remember the big stereos we used to come home with and all the tape cassettes? Of course they could speak English when it suited them. Yeah. When it suited them, spoke better English than me and you, Harry, I can tell you.
No, that was the second.
I spoke money,
How many
yeah.
times did you go out altogether?
I've done, in my career in the Army, I've done 6 tours overseas, 3 of them to Lebanon. I went back overseas, as you said, in November 1989, and then I had the incident.
Right.
And then I went back again. I went back again to Lebanon in 1993.
Okay, tell me a little bit about this, because when I was talking to you about doing this, you made kind of light that no one would be interested in it. But I've been speaking to a lot of people since then, and we remember you coming home to Mohaven Amor and the big banners and everything like that. But can you explain to me exactly what happened?
It's something, you know, because nobody asks me really, you know what I mean? It's a long time ago, but it's something I remember quite well. Basically, what happened, Harry, was that, remember, we're there to keep the peace. And there was a couple of warring factions, what I call them warring factions, within South Lebanon. There was the Hezbollah, who were the Party of God, backed by the Iranians, who really hadn't gained control by the time I was there. But then you had a party called the Amal, who were local militia to look after the Lebanese people. And on the other side of the fence, you had the Christians backed by the Israelis. So that's the buffer in the middle of it. So this particular morning on the 21st of February, I'd been in the base camp, and a couple of the local Amal had fired machine gun fire at the Christian compound, which is kind of a fort, for want of a better word, on top of a hill, a big mound, which commanded the area in which we were in the village of Adada. And the Christian militia, remember, they're backed again by the Israelis. The Christian militia covered a buffer zone between Lebanon and Israel, and they had retaliated by firing 7 solid shot tank rounds. And what I mean by solid shot tank rounds, big bullets, into the village, and just fired indiscriminately into the village of Adada. We all had gone to what's called groundhog, which means you take cover. After the all clear came, my platoon commander was ordered to go in and see if there's any casualties. So he chose me to come in as a rifleman, as we call it, shotgun, to ride in the back of the Jeep. Went into the village to see if there was any casualties, anything we could do. And a couple of locals had pointed at the damage, and the damage done to the houses, you know, just a big, you know, knocked 3 of them, I think, were completely gone. And, you know, there was superficial damage to them. But we were more concerned about injuries. Was there anybody injured, we asked. No, there was no injuries, and we were thankful for that. With that, somebody had shouted to us, Irish boom boom here, on which he was explaining to us, this is where the Amal had fired at the Christians. Oh, right, so he showed us this area, and it was a kind of what we'd call a good firing position that would give you a commanding view of the compound. But there was no signs of empty cartridges, there was no sign of anything around. We thought nothing of it. Then he called us again, maybe about 10 feet away, boom, boom, here. And he brought us over to, if you look at the machine gun in the corner like that, it's called a light machine gun. There was a Russian, one of those, lying on the ground with a full belt of ammunition on it. Now, when a belt of ammunition carries 50 rounds, but this belt, I remember it was maybe 200 rounds because of a big, long belt of ammunition. And he says, this is where the fire came from. And I remember walking around it, but there was no empty casings around it. There was nothing. They hadn't fired from there. They'd fired and moved and left it there. This goes into something else later on. So anyway, my platoon commander, he ordered the driver to just go to a different area so he could radio in, telling that we're after finding a machine gun. So I walked around it to make sure it was safe. I opened it to make sure, opened the working mechanism, and cleared the weapon, make sure there was no weapon. If you understand the word, when a weapon is cocked, there's a rifle charging a breech. There was no rounds charging a breech in this. So I cleared the weapon, and we were ordered from base to stay where we are, that the company mobile reserve, in other words, help was coming out, basically. So we stayed in situ. Within 4 or 5 minutes, the company mobile reserve had come out, which is a corporal and 4 other guys in an armoured car with the crew of that, and our CO arrived out as well. He just asked what happened, and we explained to him. Okay, he said, I want you to put the machine gun into the back of the armoured car. We're now leaving the village, heading back to camp. So if you remember, Harry, if I can explain this right, the armoured car and the Jeep in front. We're in the back of the armoured car, and then we heard over the radio that there were a number of men moving towards us, and one of them was carrying an RPG. Now, if you're in the back of an armoured car and an RPG goes in, so straight away we're told to get out of the RPG, and we're walking towards into the centre of the village, but we saw nobody. What happened then was a few of the locals came up to us who we knew. Remember I said to you that we'd gone the second time, we knew everybody. And they were aggressive, but they weren't armed, and they were all shouting at us because we were taking a weapon away. And we just go, look, it's okay, there's no problem. So we started walking again, they disappeared, and then they came back armed. And this is what, we'd been in the vehicle at this time. We had met them, we had got into the vehicle, and it's when we got told they were coming back with the RPG that we dismounted from the vehicle again. Now I recall, as we were coming through the village, and we heard shots going off, not particularly in our direction, but a number of rounds being fired. We then got the order to cock our weapons, which means to charge your weapons. And I knew straight away, look, this is getting a wee bit, okay, right? So I remember we're carrying the Steyr rifle. It was carrying a sling around my neck. I took the sling off and cocked the rifle. And we said, okay, let's just keep this together. And out of nowhere, the local Amal guys had surrounded us. Now, we were on a patrol at the time of 12 of us. Remember, the Jeep is in front. It's a small, it's called a P4, it's a French Jeep, painted in white livery with a UN sign on it. The guy in the armoured car, the Sisu armoured car, which were brand new to the Irish Army at the time, there's 2 guys in that, the driver and the guy, the gunner, who's got a machine gun on top of it, and the rest of us. So it's 12 in total. So if you can picture that, we're walking out in protective column. We're all moving, covering each other, going out. And all of a sudden, the guys are in front of us. And I was the last man in the column. And those 2 guys who we knew called, can I mention their names? Yeah, I suppose you can, yeah. Mohammed and Joseph, they were 2 brothers. And Mohammed had been a friend of mine from my previous time. You know, we'd shook hands and we'd been in his house drinking shai, met his family. And they were getting very aggressive. And out of nowhere, the younger brother, Joseph, was wrestling with one of our soldiers. And he was wrestling with him and he shot him in the back of the leg. And when that the other soldier fell to the ground, what happened then was that the round started firing everyone. Mohammed picked his rifle up. He was shot down. He was shot by the Irish, and we went to cover. And I remember very clearly that that Mohammed fell to the ground. And you know, you've seen the films that do all this. Mohammed fell to the ground as if somebody just pulled a socket out of his back. He just collapsed onto the ground. I remember he was 4 feet, 5 feet away from me, and I remember turning and running to cover behind a small an electricity substation that was it was about a 3-story block building, and there was a captain beside me. And the guy who had the RPG had ran up past me with his left hand in the air, the RPG cradled on his right shoulder, shouting, "No fire, no fire." And I had him in my sights. And I remember just dropping the sights because the articles of the rules of engagement, he's running away, doesn't oppose a threat. But he got to the end of the alleyway, he turned around and he fired the RPG. And it's one of those things I remember most vividly about the day, was that the RPG came directly straight at us, just white light. And it's supersonic, but I mean, Harry, it was floating towards us. And I could just see it coming past me, just this surreal moment. Fixed my beret. And my platoon commander was on the other side, and I had my rifle, and I ran over towards him. And as I turned round, if you play football, you get it, and it's as if you win. But I knew straight away I'd been shot. So I ripped up my flak jacket, the body armour we were in, and I couldn't see anything. But just as I was opening my mouth, there was just blood. I found it later, my lung was punctured. So I collapsed, but I was still conscious. But they got me into the back of the armoured car, and I turned. And if I hadn't turned, I would have got it in the chest. But I, fortunately enough, so I turned, and then I got injured. So they got us in the back of the armoured car, and we were casavacked or medevac straight out. At the time, we had a guy with us who has since become a very close friend of mine, and he was in one of the infantry units in Dublin, but he'd been in the Army Ranger Wing. He was well clued and went switched on, you know. And of course, look, we were only kids, but this fella knew what to do. He realised the colour of the blood. He realised then I had some sort of chest injury. He put me in a recovery position, was able to clear my mouth and just enough to get me to the medical aid post. And what was basically happening, I was drowning in my own blood. That's how what was happening to me. And we'd one surgeon in the army at the time, a guy called Commander Charles O'Malley, who was a couple of surgeons, sorry, but they had to all rotate in Lebanon. Fortunately for me, he was there. And he ripped up my shirt. And I remember this quite vividly. You know, like a big pen with the hollow, and he broke my chest bone, and straight away I could breathe. And I remember saying to him, you know, I had an expletive. I said, "That hurt." I remember saying it to him, and I met him subsequently a number of years later. Do you remember what you said to me? Yeah, I said, "That fucking hurt."
But Rico, how long was it then before you came home?
Okay, what happened was then we were medevac to Nakuru, which is UNIFIL headquarters, just on the Israeli border, to a Swedish hospital. Now, remember, that's Aunt Paddy and I. We all ended up in Sweden Medcoy. However, my injuries were the most life-threatening at the time. So I was sent to a hospital in Rambam Hospital in Haifa, in Israel, where I got fantastic treatment. In fact, I couldn't speak at the time because of all the tubes went into me, but there was a nurse from Belfast, and she was relaying stories back to my parents, letting them know that I was fine. And I remember I said to you earlier there was no mobile phones, there was nothing. To ring home, that I had to crank a phone beside me, put it to my ear. This is back in Lebanon. And put it on my phone, and somebody had to squeeze the send button, you know, to speak to my parents on the phone. Anyway, look, that's another part of the story. But anyway, so I came back, I convalesced a wee bit in Nakura, and I was home on the 15th of March, just in time for St. Patrick's Day. So I had a crack in St. Patrick's Day, I can tell you.
Were you... you went back again?
I went back again, Harry, and... I wanted to go back. I wanted, you know, this thing you fall off a bicycle, get back onto it. Yeah, I wanted to go back. But subsequently, looking back, and maybe it wasn't the fairest thing to do to my parents, you know, but I wanted to go back. And I'm glad I went back. And I just put it to bed. So, you know what I mean? That's it.
The memory I have of it, of course, it was big news because there was very few, as you rightly said, you were out there as a peacekeeping force. Very few Irish soldiers were injured at all, you know.
I remember the year before, Michael McNeely, who had been my recruit platoon, he was killed in Lebanon, 10 feet from where I was injured, almost to the day. He was killed on the 24th of February 1989. My injury, the 21st of February 1990, 10 feet from Mickey.
Can you remember coming home and seeing the reception you got?
For sure, yeah. Well, the night we came home, we were kept in Brickens Hospital in Dublin, but my family were there to meet me. And when I came home, then everybody was upside my parents' house up in Agamine Park. That was fantastic. And, you know, and the people, the well-wishers, you know, I think Dundalk, we get an awful lot of negativity. There's good people in Dundalk, as well, you know. You know, you could feel the good wishes, the genuine love and warmth of people and the prayers and everybody. And you could feel that, and, you know.
But the whole family, forever, like, forever, you know, your mum and dad your mum, Lord Mercer, and your dad, like, they were so well liked in the town. And your dad, like, the minute he came to Dundalk, people loved him and still do.
Mm. Very true, yeah. So yeah, that was element as well, where people might stop my dad in the street and ask, is my mother in the street, and my sisters and my brother would ask, you know. Alvaro got some, mileage out of it, I can tell you.
Yeah.
Oh, Alvaro, yeah. Oh, how's Ricardo? It's grand, I'll have another pint yet.
And, you know, we're now on, how long have you been in the army, and what's the future for you?
I now go into my 35 years. I've got a good position within battalion headquarters here in the army. So, look, I have another few years to go. I'm happy staying where I am. I've no intention of, maybe another trip overseas. I'll see what Anita says about that. But, look, I've had a great career, Harry, and it's coming to the end, but it's not over yet.
Now, you, before we go, we're sitting in the museum down here in the barracks. Is that open, or do people have to ring up and make an appointment?
It's unfortunate because it's in a military establishment, you can't just walk to the gate. And however, you can contact us anytime at 0429 332296, make an arrangement to come and see the museum at any time, or contact the staff up in the county museum. They're very, very good, and if they'll contact me, and we'll accommodate as much as we can.
It's very rarely you see somebody that likes their job as much as you do, because everywhere you've been, you present this very good image of the army.
I suppose I do, but look, I'm fortunate, you know, and it's probably to do with my parents. I've always had a good positive attitude towards things, you know. You spoke about that thing in Lebanon. You have to get better, you have to move on, and it's all about having a positive mental attitude. The army's a great job. Sometimes it's not, you know. But you have to, as we say, just get on with it, you know. But you have to have a good attitude to anyone.
When we were coming in, we saw some soldiers there out in the yard.
They're new recruits, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the way you start.
Exactly. Only the kit and equipment they have is much better than we have, yeah. But exactly the same. And I spoke to them. In fact, one of the things when they initially came in was I did give them a bit of a history about the barracks and what it was about and what the army was about. So, you know, I said to them, you're doing exactly what I've done 35 years ago. And they looked at me and says, that fella must be 117. What do you mean 35 years?
Rico, can I thank you very much?
Thank you very much, Harry. It's been a pleasure.
Listen to lots more epic interviews at gatheringheritage.com.